Les colloques du Collège de France.
Good morning, everyone. So first, I would like to warmly thank Stanislas Dehaene for organizing this quite extraordinary event, and also for inviting me to chair the first session of today. Well, yesterday was already an incredible day of science and celebration, and I'm truly honored to open the second day, which promises to be just as inspiring. So we will begin with a topic that is, would I dare to say, Stan's very first scientific love, numerical and mathematical development. This field has grown enormously in the last decades, thanks in no small part to Stan's pioneering work. And today we have the pleasure of hearing from four colleagues with research on the brain's representation of numbers and how these representations change with development, continues to push this area forward in new and exciting directions. So the first talk will be by Ed Hubbard. He is an associate professor of educational psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he directs the Educational Neuroscience Lab. His research bridges neuroscience and education, focusing on how perceptual and cognition and cognitive systems support the acquisition of complex math concepts. So after completing his PhD on synesthesia in the US, inspired by the number sense, Ed wrote to Stanislas Dehaene in what he describes as awful French. Stan invited him to Paris to give a talk. And despite a memorable first day across from the Moulin Rouge, Ed was hooked. He joined Stan's lab in 2004 as one of the first Americans in the Numbra network, working at the old SHFG site before the move to Neurospin, alongside many of the people here today. Those years left a lasting mark. In his talk today, Ed will show how he has carried forward Stan's idea of neuronal cycling to argue that even fractions, often thought to lack perceptual grounding, may build on a dedicated ratio processing system. Ed, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you, Stan, for being here. Thank you it's really, for me, kind of a bit of a homecoming. So I was here from 2004 to 2008. And when I first even imagined coming here to France, I was a PhD student. And as Mary mentioned, I was working on synesthesia, so people who see colors for letters and numbers. And I started looking around. We started with some behavioral work, and I was curious about, you know, well, what are the brain systems for reading? And I find these papers by Stanislas Dehaene and Laurent Cohen. I'm like, okay, this is good. And then I was interested in another form of synesthesia where people sometimes report that numbers have spatial locations. And I find myself reading the number sense. And at the same time, we were doing a journal club about consciousness. And I find myself reading papers by Leonard Nakash and Stanislas Dehaene. And I'm like, I say to myself, I'm like, my God, this man is everywhere. He's doing all of this exciting science. And for me, I had been fortunate enough to study French for 5 years in high school. So I wrote to Stan in bad French. He says it wasn't awful, maybe just bad. But I plucked up my courage and said, you know, hey, I would love to come and do a postdoc. And he said, well, we can make that work, but I don't have funding. So first, come give a talk, tell us about your work, and then write a grant. And so we wrote a grant to the Thiessen Foundation, and they funded it. And in the meantime, between when I got the grant and when I actually arrived, Stan and Brian Butterworth and Marco Zorzi and a whole group of people got another Marie Curie Research Training Network grant. And that's the grant that brought me here. Stan said to me afterwards, he said, you know, would you like to give up your Thiessen grant? Thiessen was only 2 years. Marie Curie paid 50% more. Of course I made that move. So I came here, and this is a picture. I couldn't find a picture with Stan, but I did find a picture. This is from Orsay. And this is in the early days when we were first starting to try and figure out some of the correspondences between monkey and human parietal areas that became the 2005 paper that we wrote. Since then, I've gone back to the United States and have really worked taking this sort of basic science and thinking more about the education side, worked with Bruce McCandless for almost four years, before starting my own lab at the University of Wisconsin. And so I'll start by telling you guys a little bit about where we got to here. And hearkening back to Stan's introductory comments yesterday about sort of the human singularity, what makes humans unique? And when we think about the things that make humans unique, one of the ways that we can approach this is to think about these sort of cultural origins of these human-specific abilities. So we know that early number representations have been around since at least 20,000 years ago, simple tally marks, count marks. We can see formal mathematics, basic geometry from 3,500 years ago. And then we can see that all the way up to, for example, modern mathematical objects. And perhaps part of what has given us this uniquely human ability to do mathematics is that we have culture that allows us to preserve and pass on the fruits of previous thinkers' labors. That when one person comes up with a good idea, they can, in various different ways, communicate that, teach it, and then, of course, write it to pass it along. But another way to think about the origins of human-specific abilities is to ask about these brain systems. And so one of the things that Stan first really highlighted is this sort of correspondence between brain systems that Andreas Nieder told us about so beautifully yesterday in the non-human primate for number processing and human parietal regions. But at the same time, human brains aren't just big monkey brains. And I like especially this figure that captures a little bit of this idea. So here what they've done is they've looked at the amount that the brain has had to expand. If you compare this monkey organization with the human organization, what you see is that across evolution, that's the top figure, these brain areas are differentially expanded. So the brighter the orange, the more that brain area has increased from the monkey organization to the human organization. So if we want to understand what makes humans unique, looking in the early visual areas probably isn't going to tell us what makes humans unique. We need to be looking in some of these parietal areas, some of these frontal areas, areas for language comprehension. But it's not just that these brains have evolved phylogenetically, but also within the lifespan of an individual, ontogenetically. We can see that these same brain areas increase in size. So those areas that were most affected by evolution are the ones that are also most affected by development. So building these kinds of bridges between a phylogenetic approach and an ontogenetic approach to think about the origins of human uniqueness. And in particular, I want to sort of capitalize on Stan's notion of neuronal recycling. So for those of you that are familiar with numerical cognition, this figure really doesn't tell you anything that you don't already know. In non-human primates, there are well-established systems for processing quantities, basic numerosities, in parietal and frontal regions. In three-month-old infants, some of you are responsible for this figure even, we see a similar sort of pattern in five to nine-year-old children learning to translate between quantities and symbols. This 1999 paper from Stan and Liz, the science paper that we talked about yesterday, showing the brain areas that are involved in approximate subtraction, and even on up into integral calculus. And so the question that my lab has mostly been focused on is how do we get from this to this? And thinking both about the phylogenetic components and the ontogenetic components. So when we think about mathematics, we often think about mathematics as being this kind of progression, this almost sort of straightforward, easy progression from basic systems for numbers on into these systems that eventually allow us to do things like integral calculus. And at least at a course level, maybe this is true, but when we actually think about what children go through, it's never straightforward. Children struggle. Children sometimes get things where we're surprised that they understand them. Sometimes they struggle with things that we think would be easy. Sometimes the exact same types of problems, they turn out to struggle with certain ones and not with other ones. And so this mathematical progression involves various different sort of fits and starts where progress is easy or progress is hard. And for the past decade, my lab has really turned its attention toward thinking about fractions as being one particular source of human uniqueness. So one reason that we've turned towards fractions is that they're important. So looking at education research, looking at developmental research, we see that fractions is this key gatekeeper to higher order STEM abilities. So we know, for example, that fifth grade children, so these are children who are roughly 10 to 11 years old in the United States, but also Canada, in England, this meta-analysis looked at all three of these countries. Children who struggle with fractions in fifth grade go on to struggle with algebra. And children who do well with fractions in fifth grade go on to do better with algebra. And this isn't just a case of people who are good at things or good at things. You can control for various other cognitive domains and show that those skills in fractions are uniquely related to algebra outcomes. Why that is, we still don't know. There's still an open empirical question about why fraction skills contribute to algebra skills. But we've known for a decade now that fractions do have this important role in laying the foundation for algebraic thinking and reasoning. Obviously, algebra opens up all of the higher order math skills. And now, even 17 years ago, the US Math Advisory Panel said that fractions knowledge was the most important skill that is not presently developed in the school age population. So for almost 20 years in the United States, there has been this real focus on thinking about fractions as being a problem area. And so fractions are hard, or fractions are important, but they're also really hard. And I'll give you a real world example here. So in the late 1980s, the American hamburger chain A&W introduced a third pound hamburger. Those of you that are used to the metric system, you don't have to deal with this stuff. Us in America, this is part of our normal experience. And maybe this is actually part of why fractions are such a topic in the United States, because we deal with half a teaspoon and half a cup and a third pound hamburger and all of these crazy things on a regular basis. So A&W introduced a third pound hamburger to compete with the McDonald's quarter pounder. But what they found was nobody was buying it. And so they did blind taste tests, and for those of you that are not familiar, A&W is far superior to McDonald's. So the burger definitely tasted better. It wasn't that it was a bad hamburger. They asked people, half of the adults in this study group in the United States said, look, you're ripping us off. You're charging us the same amount of money for a third pound hamburger as we could spend for a quarter pounder. These are adults, half of them. The CEO of A&W at the time writes about this in his autobiography, and this is sort of how I found this example. So there's clearly some difficulties. I'll give you another, which is this idea that multiplying by a fraction leads to a smaller number. In the United States, most people, if I ask them what it means to divide by a fraction, and you can ask yourself this question, what does it mean to divide by a fraction? We know the algorithm, we know we invert and multiply, but we don't actually know why that works. We just know that that's what we're supposed to do. So even as adults, we struggle with various different aspects of fractions, and part of what this means is that we tend to just rely on rote procedures. And then we don't know when we're making huge mistakes. There's a classic math example where people were given a multiple choice question, which was 7 eighths plus 12 thirteenths. And the choices were 1, 2, 19, and 21. If you think about it, 7 eighths is almost 1. 12 thirteenths is almost 1. So almost 1 plus almost 1 should be almost 2. Should be easy. 50% of eighth graders in the US pick 19 or 21, off by an order of magnitude. 15% of undergraduates at my university pick 19 or 21. This is a highly selective state school. It's supposed to be the best of the best in Wisconsin, and 15% of those undergraduates still pick 19 or 21. So people struggle with fractions. So why are fractions hard? And one idea that we get from the numerical cognition literature, and this is sort of, by way of honoring my postdoc mentor, I am going to disagree with him on an important point here. So Lisa, Stan, and Liz said, why is number so easy and yet so hard? first number is easy because it is supported by core systems of representations with long ontogenetic histories. Second number is hard when it goes beyond the limits of those systems. When humans push number representations further to embrace fractions, square roots, negative numbers, and complex numbers, they move even further from the intuitive sense of number provided by the core systems. Stan, this is, if you're following along at home with the book, this is the revised edition page numbers. So what modern mathematicians call numbers includes zero, negative integers, fractions, irrational numbers such as pi. He says, these mathematical entities are so difficult for us to accept and so defy intuition because they do not correspond to any pre-existing category in our brain. To function in an intuitive mode, our brain needs images. And as far as number theory is concerned, evolution has endowed us with an intuitive picture only of positive integers. Or, in a slightly more simple formulation, the mathematician Leopold Kronecker says, God created the integers. All else is the work of man. So that might be an explanation for why fractions are hard. But about a decade ago, we started to think that maybe that explanation wasn't right, that maybe there was a foundation that had been missed. And we started to see evidence from, for example, infant studies. So this is Colleen McCrink and Karen Wynn. They showed that infants will habituate to the relative, I don't know why they chose Pac-Man and pellets, maybe just for their own interest. Obviously, 6-month-old infants don't care about Pac-Man, but they do care about the relative number of Pac-Man to blue dots. And so they will habituate to these various different sorts of displays, and then we'll dishabituate when the ratio of blue to yellow changes. Other studies from especially Susan Levine and Janelle and Huttenloker's lab have shown that children at 4 years old prefer to ratio match. So what they did here is they presented, for example, a target, water in a cylinder, a sort of classic Piagetian task. And then on half of the trials, they would present these targets or these foils. They'd see which of the two the children would pick. Interestingly, in this case, of course, it should be trivial, but in this case, when you scale this up, the interesting question is, what do children pick? Do they pick the one that has the same amount or the same ratio? 4-year-old children prefer to pick the ratio match. 8-year-old children will pick the one that matches. I always think about Piaget's conservation of volume. Maybe Piaget got it wrong. It's not that kids were doing something silly. It's maybe they were doing something more sophisticated than he even anticipated. And so when you think about these types of tasks, it suggests that there might be these sort of early developmental abilities. In the same way, you see from, and Andreas did not talk about this part of the work yesterday, but from Andreas Nieder's lab, using the same sort of match-to-sample task that he's used for numerosity, he has shown, he and his team have shown, that monkeys, if presented with, so say, for example, a 1-to-4 ratio or a 2-to-4 ratio, will identify the ratio that matches. And that's what you can see here. So here, this is the performance for the monkeys. If they're presented with, for example, a 2-to-4 ratio in the first interval, they will say that a 2-to-4 ratio matches. They will sometimes say a 1-to-4 ratio or a 3-to-4 ratio matches. They never say a 4-to-4 ratio matches. You see the same sort of thing for 3-to-4 ratios. Up here, this is the data from German college students. And what you can see is that the German college students and the monkeys look quite similar. And then you can look at neuronal recordings, especially in the intraparietal sulcus, and you can see that there are, for example, these cells that are tuned to ratio. And so these sorts of findings from infant development, from early education, from non-human primate studies, got us thinking that maybe there was really a foundation. And we started to argue in favor of what we call this ratio processing system, this idea that perhaps we come equipped with a foundation that we didn't appreciate in 1997 or in 2004, that we have this ability to perceive ratios, to compare ratios, and that maybe that can provide a foundation for understanding fractions. And then education, if it's effective, will build these links between the symbolic and non-symbolic systems. That will translate to an understanding of fraction magnitude, in turn to pencil and paper fraction knowledge, and then even eventually to algebra. And so we came up with a series of kind of predictions. The first is that ratio acuity should correlate with symbolic fraction skills. Second, that symbolic fractions don't have to be understood just by thinking about the individual components, the numerator and denominator, the top and bottom numbers. That we should be able to show that they access an analog magnitude representation and don't require slow mental computation. It should be abstract and separate from the ANS. It should be present before formal education, and that these systems should be recycled for symbolic fractions processing. And so the first test of this, we used undergraduate students at the University of Madison. And so we got about 200 of them, and we asked them to do a battery of ratio comparison tasks. So here, your job is just to pick which of these two ratios is the larger one. And in this case, even though the lines are smaller, the white to black ratio is larger on the left side of the screen. So you can see that this is the larger ratio here. You would do the same thing for each of these. This is the larger ratio. You would do this for dots, and then you can do this where these dots are integrated. Critically, we had a series of control tasks. So we asked about ANS acuity, we looked at line length acuity, we looked at cognitive control using the flanker task. So one of the things we know about fractions is that they lead people to think about the magnitudes in the wrong way, like the A&W hamburger example. We have to use inhibitory control in some way to account for that. And so we looked at this flanker task. We had three measures of fraction knowledge. So we had symbolic fraction comparison, we had number line estimation, this was just 0 to 1, putting a fraction in the correct location, and we had a pencil and paper test of fraction knowledge that we drew from, for example, the TIMSS, the NAEP, the National Assessment of Educational Progress in the United States, all of these different tests. And as students at the University of Wisconsin, they had entrance exams, and so we had their algebra scores. And what you can see here is that people who did better, and these are all college students, remember, people who did better on our fraction ratio battery here did better on symbolic fraction comparison. They were more precise in putting the fraction in the correct location on the number line. They did better on our pencil and paper assessment of fraction knowledge, and they had higher algebra entrance exam scores. Critically, when we looked at the contribution of ANS acuity to this, it wasn't explaining any of the variance, really, like 1-2%. So that's already one piece that makes us think about the RPS as being separate from the ANS, is that one of these measures, this ratio processing measure, accounts for variance, whereas the ANS measure doesn't. The flanker task also didn't account for variance in this performance. So this started us down this path of starting to look at links between symbolic fractions and non-symbolic fractions. So I can put a check mark by the first bullet point here. Let's see about the second one. And to take advantage of, to explore the second question, we used our old friend, the SNARC effect, the Spatial Numerical Association of Response Codes effect. This is obviously something that is near and dear to Stan's heart, and this is, after leaving behind some of the synesthesia work, something that Stan and I, and then Stan Bruce and I, and many of the other people in this room had worked on together when I was here from 2004 to 2008. So this is a major topic for us. And the basic idea here is that you simply press a button to indicate whether the number is odd or even. So you might press the left button for odd, and then in other blocks you would press the right button for odd. This actual version comes from a draft of the paper that Philippe created when we were publishing this now 20 years ago. And you then can visualize the SNARC effect by looking at the amount of time that it takes you to press the right button versus the left button. You're slower on the right, and therefore right minus left is positive. You, for small numbers, you're slower on the left. For large numbers, so that difference is therefore negative. And so you can see this kind of classic regression slope. This is what we're looking for. And the question we asked is, well, what about fractions? And we weren't the first people to ask this question. So there was a previous paper that had said, you know, we find the opposite. We find this reversed mental number line. But my then PhD student Liz Tamarian and I looked at this and we said, you know, what's going on with the stimuli? And we realized that these fractions were all unit fractions, 1/9, 1/8, 1/7, that contribute to a sort of focus on the components. You can essentially ignore the numerator, and just think about the denominator in reverse. And they would ask people to compare against 1/5. And so we redid this because the original study had been done in Italy. We redid this with American students, and we said, do American students show the same effect? And that's exactly what we found here. But then we just used a different set of stimuli. We used all of the irreducible fractions, so 1/9, 2/7, 4/9, all of them between 0 and 1, and we asked them to compare against 1/2. So now pick the larger number. Is it more or less than 1/2? And what we find there is that by simply changing the stimulus set, we eliminate that strategic effect where people will focus on the components. And instead, they will show this really beautiful classic snark effect. They will show this holistic number representation. We also showed in another sample that whole number snark and fraction snark correlated with each other, again suggesting this kind of integrated representation of numbers. So symbolic fractions can be understood holistically on the mental number line. Turning now to whether or not symbolic fractions access an analog magnitude representation, we took advantage of the classic numerical distance effect. And so this is an effect that goes all the way back to 1967. This is not new. Stan obviously worked on this as well. This is an early paper looking at two-digit number comparison. And number comparisons served as the basis, for example, for ERP studies and fMRI studies about the different components of number processing that are part of the triple code. And then also some of the work on consciousness, thinking about number distance with primed versus unprimed numerical magnitudes. So here's data from children. This comes from Sekulow and Mirkowitz, but the figure comes from Daniel Ansari's paper. This is the classic distance effect. People are slower if the numbers are more similar to each other. They're faster if the numbers are more dissimilar. Children overall are slower when they're younger. They get faster as they get older. And the magnitude of this distance effect also decreases. What about fractions? Can we show that there's a distance effect for fractions? And critically, can we show that that depends on the holistic magnitude of the fractions, not just on the components? So what we did, and this is with John Binzak and Percival Matthews, was to look at comparison. Two fractions are on the screen, 7/9 versus 1/4. Raise your hand if you think that the fraction on the left is larger. Raise your hand if you think the fraction on the right is larger. Pretty easy, right? Now, in other trials, I might give you, say, 5/8 versus 7/9. And you feel how that's much more difficult. Or 2/5 versus 1/4. You can eventually get there, but it takes a little longer. And so what we did here was to just vary within subjects the numerical distance, but we also had these other notations that go back to that ratio processing system. So the idea here was to ask participants to pick the larger of the line ratios, just as we had done before, to pick the larger of the symbolic fractions, and to pick the larger when they're asked to translate between the notations. And what we can see here is our classic distance effect. So here, this is the reaction time data. You can see that people are slower, as you would expect, on the closer fractions. They are faster on the farther fractions. One of the things that really struck us is that people are fastest by about a quarter of a second, 250 milliseconds, they're fastest for the line-line comparison. And that's important because when we started doing this work with the symbolic fractions, people would say to us, well, I look at this and I go, that's about 8/10 and that's a quarter. And if that's 8/10 and that's a quarter, then 8/10 is bigger than a quarter, and so I'm going to pick this one. And my answer is, really? You think you're doing all that extra work and you're 250 milliseconds faster? That doesn't add up. So what we've been arguing is that this is evidence also for this kind of perceptual foundation for this non-symbolic ratios, and that translating to symbols, whether there's one symbol or two symbols, takes some extra time. We then extended this to children. This is in second grade and fifth grade children. And you can see, first of all, they can do the task. So American second graders in and around Madison, Wisconsin can reliably pick the larger of the two fractions. We see the same pattern. Notice that now for the children, it looks like there's an extra cost for two symbolic fractions versus one symbolic fraction versus no symbolic fractions. But the basic pattern is still here. Fifth graders overall show the same pattern. They're a little faster, slightly lower error rates, but the basic sort of patterns here. Another question that we asked is whether or not fractions require this slow mental computation. And so what we did here was, again, ask people to pick the larger of two fractions. Sometimes they were presented as sort of typical common fractions, sometimes as decimals, and sometimes in this mixed format. But the thing that John Binzak did that was really devious is that he imposed deadlines. So he required participants to respond within 1 second, so this is one group of participants, within 2 seconds, within 5 seconds, and by changing the deadlines, we can push around decision boundaries. So we can think about this kind of classic model of mental processing stages where you're presented with a stimulus, there's some fixed encoding time, there's some decision boundary, and then there's the response output. Stan, this is very much inspired, obviously, by thinking about all the work that you did with Mariano, thinking about decomposing mental stages. And so, not to go into all six of the experiments here, but to give you a flavor of what we see, when we ask people to compare decimals, they are faster and more accurate than when we ask them to compare symbolic fractions. So there may be some translation there. But notice in this the blue line, the mixed case, there's no additional cost of translating. So you get this fraction to fraction, you get this decimal to decimal, and this mixed case. Here we've kind of developed a cartoon model where we can look at the decision boundaries, we can look at the evidence accumulation time, and then when we give people a really sharp deadline, what you can see is that the rate at which they're accumulating evidence is pretty consistent, but the decision boundaries are lower. Notice that these distance effects now flatten out so that all the responses are within 1,000 and the errors start to show more of that sort of pattern. So this suggests that people can access a sort of analog magnitude representation without slow mental computations. I'll very quickly mention, and I added this yesterday after Andreas's beautiful talk about sort of abstract approximate number representations. We've been asking this question about whether or not the RPS also works across auditory and visual modalities and across different stimulus types. The basic paradigm is, again, to just pick the larger of the two, but now they're presented sequentially. And what you can see here is this beautiful psychophysical data that Caroline Cheng, who's a now second year PhD student working with Percival and with me, has shown this beautiful psychophysical data where you simply pick the larger of the two ratios and you can see when they're line to line, you get this really nice curve. If you do the auditory to auditory, this temporal task, you can see that the precision is less, but that people can do the task. Critically for us, we were interested in these conditions where they're asked to cross between auditory and visual modalities. And again, you can see that psychophysical performance on these two tasks is nearly identical to what you see here. So you get these beautiful data where people reliably pick the large ones at the endpoints, and in the middle, they're struggling. And you see this very nice sort of behavioral data here. So maybe it's abstract across different modalities. It's also potentially separable. And I won't go into all the details on that. But part of what we were thinking is that it might be that there's a sort of parallel system. And that parallel system would say, take the old number model and remove some of these steps and allow us to combine across these ratios to do the difference. Let me quickly talk a little bit, like in my last negative 2 minutes, about the fMRI version. You've already seen the task. You've already seen the behavioral data. What do we see in the brain? So here, this is adult data, and we simply ask them to pick the larger of the two ratios in those same different notations that you've seen before. And what we see here is that we get our old friends, the intraparietal sulcus, premotor areas, inferior frontal, this whole classic network. And we see that that's true for the non-symbolic ratios in red. That's true for the symbolic fractions in blue and for this novel mapping task, this sort of magenta color. So that's the adult data. But the key for us was to look at children in the United States who either haven't yet had extensive fraction instruction, so second graders, is this system present before formal instruction? and fifth graders who have had formal instruction. And first, in the scanner, we show that children can do this task. When we look at brain systems, what we see is really striking, and I'm going to especially focus here. For young children, second graders, who haven't yet had formal instruction with fractions, we already see this really nice right parietal specialization for non-symbolic ratios. But we don't see any sort of specialization for symbolic fractions in second graders. They can do the task, but they don't yet seem to show this kind of neuronal specialization. Fifth graders, after 2 years of intensive instruction, a lot of it focused on fractions in the United States, now show this emerging specialization. And so what we think here is that we're really seeing evidence for neuronal recycling. One interesting finding, this is especially for the people who are deep into this, the left hemisphere, we see changes mostly in this kind of representational similarity analysis, whereas the right hemisphere showed the big changes with the univariate analysis. So that might be something that's worth sort of thinking a little bit more, the left and the right hemispheres here. So we can go through and say we've tested most of these predictions and found that most of them are true. So where does that leave us? And I want to finish with a sort of big picture return. So there's a lot of evidence that fractions might have this kind of foundation, but they're still hard. So that becomes a problem for the ideas that we were kicking around 20 years ago, 25 years ago about why fractions are hard. And it turns out, if we look at the past 20 years, it's not just fractions where we've identified potential perceptual foundations. You look at some of the work on geometry, Stan's work with Lorenzo, thinking about graph perception. Over and over again in the 20, 25 years since these early publications, we found foundations. And even Liz told us about how basic arithmetic can be quite difficult, even in people who have these foundations. So what I'm thinking is that instead we need to take neuronal recycling seriously, and it's not just that we have or don't have a foundation, it's the degree to which our educational practices align with the computational constraints that are there in those foundational systems. I sort of harken back to some of my own earlier work with Stan, thinking about the mental number line and numbers in space, but it's not just that. So there's hopefully, and I will not belabor the point, but there's now potentially alternative ways to approach fractions instruction, ways to think about these foundational systems and to move beyond perhaps what we have been doing, especially in the United States, where most fractions are pizza fractions. And these might have certain properties that help us and certain properties that get in the way. So it's not enough to just say we have this intuitive or informal foundation. We have to develop these pedagogical steps that allow us to build this. And there are a number of research groups that have tried to start to move in this direction. So maybe it's not just presence or absence. And I've titled this slide to honor Stan and repeal his easy hard suggestion with apologies to Schmitty Stevens. So it's not that it's just a foundational system that's present or absent. It might really be this deep alignment between these foundational systems and educational approaches. And the basic science is now mature enough that we can start to really do something where we say to educators, we're finding these systems. Let's try and leverage them. Let's try and use them. We still need education researchers on board to start to make these changes, to try these different pedagogical approaches, to work with us, to think about what our basic science is telling us. But this is where the science is taking us. And this, to me, is the really exciting part. And so I'll give Stan the last word here. He said, in the revised version of the number sense, he said, great strides have been made in our understanding of how arithmetic is implemented in the brain. Applications of cognitive neuroscience to education are therefore no longer a bridge too far. On the contrary, many conceptual and empirical research methods are now available. Innovative educational programs can be introduced, and we have all the tools in hand to study their impact on children's brains and minds. The very last words of the revised edition of his book is, "The classroom should be our next laboratory." And I share with him exactly that point. Thank you very much.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.